Welcome to New World Notes. I am Kenneth Doust. If you are listening to this program, chances are high that you're well aware that reality is very different from the image presented on TV or in Home and Gardens magazine. The corporate media would love us to think, in fact, the corporate media tries very hard to persuade us, that bigger cars are better than small, that cars are better than trains, that McMansions are more desirable than townhouses. Try to persuade us that new technology will provide abundant energy, that Newt Gingrich is a serious thinker, that Lindsay Lohan's legal problems are important to us all, and that global warming and peak oil are not. Speaking of peak oil, when my neighbors in my modest Connecticut town get back from Walmart in their SUVs, they're out noisily burning hydrocarbons with their leaf blowers, removing every bit of free organic fertilizer from their lawns, after which they will replenish the soil more or less by adding nitrogen fertilizer, which is derived from hydrocarbons. Later, of course, we'll burn some more hydrocarbons in the lawnmower, immediately followed by the leaf blower again. It's April, so there are no actual leaves to blow, but now we blow grass clippings. In a saner world, of course, instead of consuming a large amount of oil to turn land into a pseudo-golf green, we'd be cultivating organic gardens, fertilizing the ground with natural compost, and very likely not living in single-family houses in the first place. We may not have to wait until we have a saner world. In fact, we will not be able to wait until we have a saner world. The world has run out of cheap, easily accessible oil, and it is about run out of cheap, easily accessible natural gas, which means we have also run out of cheap electricity, too. The problem is explored well indeed in a Canadian documentary film made in 2004. Needless to say, we've made no progress on the energy crisis in the past 8 years, so the film is more relevant than ever. It's called The End of Suburbia. To make it fit into a couple of shows, I'm skipping the first 20 minutes, which is a history of the development of suburbs. I think the story is familiar enough to us Americans, and besides, it misses one important point. It's not just sprawling bedroom suburbs that are unsustainable. Towns like mine are becoming more and more like bedroom suburbs. As industry leaves, as Main Street stores are replaced by a Walmart outside town, as fewer and fewer things can be found within walking distance. Even cities are becoming much less self-contained, much more like suburbs, much more requiring a car and often a lawnmower too. This is certainly true of nearby Hartford, where I lived for a dozen years. The roster of experts speaking in the film is very good indeed. It includes urban planner James Howard Kunstler, political analyst Michael Ruppert, a whole bunch of petroleum scientists, and even a big energy investment broker, Matthew Simmons. This week, they'll focus on peak oil, peak natural gas, peak just about everything, and on the effects this has already had, and on some of the changes that are going to have to be made tout de suite. So park your SUV, put down that leaf blower, and let's hear about the end of suburbia. We'll start with the great electricity blackout that hit the Northeast U.S. and Southeast Canada on August 14, 2003.
Across North America, we arrive in our cars, trucks, and SUVs at gas stations like this. We expect to fill our tanks with gas at prices half those of Europe and much of the rest of the world. We expect endless natural gas to heat our homes, and we expect endless natural gas to generate the increasing amounts of electricity that we consume. Cheap, plentiful, and dependable fossil fuels have made our contemporary life possible.
Word now. now from tons of listeners telling us that the power is out. It appears the entire city is now under a massive power outage.
Please stay tuned. They need their
huge lineup, about 40 people.
The lights are also out in New York City, Pittsburgh, and Detroit.
The fire department showed up about 6 o'clock, rescued people from the elevators.
Public meetings are canceled.
In a big chunk of Ontario, this massive blackout is affecting as many as 50 million people at the moment. No idea what's going on.
This can't be happening. It's nuts. I feel like I'm in a depression.
Energy investment broker Matthew Simmons.
What the blackout actually was, it was a whole series of fuse boxes all tripping as we approached 100% capacity. And at the heart of the matter was the fact that we basically had a very mild summer, and on the 14th of August, that was the first day all summer that we were approaching 90 degree temperature at peak, all the way from the eastern shores of Lake Michigan to the Atlantic Ocean, from Toronto, Montreal, Quebec, all the way down to Washington, D.C., Cincinnati, St. Louis. And as we were approaching that, we were clearly getting higher and higher and higher towards the 100% mark because of air conditioning demand. The question wasn't the event. The question was, why did we ever allow ourselves to get so near peak capacity that it took just a branch or two to end up denying 57 million people light for several days? Everything in society that we cherish ended when the blackout came. And if that wasn't a fire drill for how important energy actually is, I can't imagine it. But you know what? People didn't get it. It wasn't a yellow light. It was a big red light. And I don't think we basically learned a thing from it.
Michael Ruppert.
Matthew Simmons is the president and CEO of Simmons & Company in Houston, Texas. It's the world's largest energy investment bank. His clients include the World Bank, Kerr McGee, Halliburton, Bechtel. I mean, he handles the biggest of the big. Matt Simmons was incredibly clear and articulate that, look, folks, we backed ourselves into the corner. We have committed to natural gas-fired plants. There's really no other alternative. Coal-fired plants are very polluting. Nuclear is way too expensive, and there's too much opposition. And hydroelectric is all used, so we're stuck with gas. But he said, there's not going to be any more generating capacity built. Why? Because there's nothing to power the plants with. And who, he asked, would take a 1% return on investment, you know, for $150 million investment in a power generating station if they know there's nothing to power the plant and no way to generate any revenue from it?
We're coming to rely more and more on natural gas for electricity generation, and natural gas is becoming more scarce.
Natural gas is no longer able to be extracted out of the ground at the same colossal rate as it has been to satisfy the enormous hunger and growing demand of North America for natural gas.
Once anyone that knows what they're talking about comes to the realization that natural gas supplies are in decline, then you immediately have to jump to the next consequence. We have to grow electricity or we will not grow our economy. Because I don't think there is any serious economist that could argue that our economy could grow by 2-3% per year and keep electricity use flat.
Economic growth is predicated upon more electricity. Electricity is predicated upon hydrocarbon energy, period. And Matthew Simmons made a very clear statement. He said future growth is not possible. And for a guy from his background to say that was one of the most, that's like the Catholic Church saying the earth is round before Galileo.
Normal for us is using immense amounts of electricity and oil to transport ourselves around. Normal is living in suburbs. Normal is consuming like there's no tomorrow. At some point, we will discover that this normal way of life has come to an end.
The 2003 blackout that denied power to 57 million people has been officially blamed on a falling branch and faulty transmission lines. Matthew Simmons believes that deeper causes exist, that North America is reaching the limits of its generating capacity due to short-sighted energy planning and political hubris. The future of electricity generation in America is being committed to a resource now in decline in America, natural gas. If it is conceivable that such gross mismanagement is leading us into an energy crisis, if it is possible that our policymakers and specialists have made such an historic mistake, what other mistakes might they have made? What have we not been told about the future of oil?
Most people, when they think about oil, think of when we're going to run out. And really, that's the wrong question to ask, because oil in the earth is not like oil or gasoline in the gas tank of your car. When your car runs out of gas, then you know there's a problem. But it doesn't run out until you get to the last drops. But with oil in the earth, it's a very different situation. We can't just pump oil out of the earth at any arbitrary rate.
All oil production, whether it's in one oil field or one country or the planet as a whole, always follows a bell curve. When you drill your first well, if the oil is close to the surface under pressure, you get a gusher. You drill more wells, the pressure goes down, the table goes down. But also you're pumping out the light sweet oil, which has risen to the top. The heavier, more expensive oil to refine, the harder to get oil, is obviously way down deep.
And you have to start pumping in water or carbon dioxide or natural gas, if you've got some around, and to start forcing the oil out, just as is happening in Saudi Arabia. So what you get is this curve. It starts, pulls up quite quickly, you get more and more and more out, then you reach this peak or plateau.
When you get to about the halfway point, the rate of that you can extract the resource peaks. And after that point, no matter how much effort you put into it, you can't continue extracting the resource at the same rate. The rate of extraction peaks and begins to fall.
We're sort of in the middle right now. We're right at the peak. We're at the point where the world is producing the most oil it will ever produce. And we are going to enter the arc of decline very shortly, if not already. It's a little bit unclear whether or not we've actually already entered it.
It's one of these phenomena that you only can say that with phenomenal, yes, we are sure, when you look back in a rearview mirror and say, gosh, obviously we peaked. But usually by the time it's clear, it's so far in the past that you're well into a totally different era.
And once it goes into that decline, it's a permanent kind of a decline. It might be a bumpy decline. And then you've got yourself a gap between what you want to use and what the supply is.
Peaking means categorically that you no longer grow.
The effect of crossing over the peak means, in essence, that every barrel of oil that you produce from that moment on will be more expensive. It will require more energy to get out of the ground, and it'll be a lesser quality of oil.
The guy that basically is most renowned for picking the peaking concept was a person named Dr. M. King Hubbert.
M. King Hubbert was probably the most famous and influential geologist of the 20th century. He worked for the U.S. Geological Survey. He worked for oil companies like Shell and their research division.
In 1956, at some industry convention, he made a startling speech and put up a bunch of graphs that basically said, from all of his calculations, sometime in the early 1970s, the United States of America would peak as an oil province. And once we reached that point, it didn't matter how much we drilled, how fast we drilled, what the price of oil was, we would basically start into decline.
Very few people took him seriously, in spite of the fact that he was so universally respected. Of course, U.S. oil production did in fact peak in 1970-71. And as a result of that, a few more people started to take him seriously.
If you go back and you read the U.S. petroleum history, one of the most incredible ironies, in my opinion, is that in 1970, Dr. Hubbert's reputation was in shambles. And the thing that his critics just said in glee, in print all the time, was, remember that old guy that said we were going to run out of oil in the early 70s? Look, the United States has never produced more than this year, the year we peaked. It seemed to take the better part of a decade or more before the oil experts in the United States looked back and said, isn't this interesting? we've clearly peaked.
He went on to predict a global oil production peak for the mid-1990s, which probably would have been accurate if it hadn't been for the oil shocks of the 1970s, which drove oil prices so high that they destroyed demand. And as a result of that, oil production actually decreased for the first time in history during the early 1970s. And this had the effect of delaying the global oil production peak for probably 10 or 15 years.
The only scientists that seem to have taken this really seriously are the old-timers, whereas the young guys are mesmerized by the technology. We created a generation and a half of Nintendo geologists that sit at their workstation and basically move around images until I say, wow, look at that bright spot.
The books on oil have been as cooked as the books at Enron.
In the late 1980s, virtually all of the Arab oil countries reported extraordinary reserve increases of something like 50 to 100% just within a year or two. And this wasn't related to any huge new discoveries. It was mostly political because OPEC was contemplating new rules at the time that would say that a country could expand its rate of production in oil sales commensurate to its reserves. So there was this incentive to report increased reserves in order to increase market share. But the evidence that that oil that has been reported as reserves is actually there is very flimsy. So we don't actually know how much oil is in Saudi Arabia or Iraq, for that matter. Is there 115 billion barrels of oil in Iraq, as is noted in the press again and again? Or could it be 40 billion or 60 billion? We don't really know. Experts like Matt Simmons, the pessimists, are saying that it's probably on the low side. Saudi Arabia may have already peaked.
If it turns out that Saudi Arabia has peaked, then categorically the world has peaked.
The debate over the peaking of oil on the planet has begun. And for the scientists involved, it is not so much a question of if or how, but when.
In May 2003, scientists from around the world spoke at a peak oil conference in Paris. Here are some of the remarks.
We always were afraid, what would it be like to live after the Hubbert peak with world oil declining? And I have this list of things. $7 trillion lost out of the U.S. stock market. 2 million jobs lost in the United States. Federal budget surplus gone. State budget surplus is gone. The middle class disappearing.
Peaking is not equivalent to running out. Everyone in the room knows this, but the lack of the people outside this room understanding that that's a serious problem.
The problem of oil depletion, and which will result in an increase in prices of petroleum, is the way it'll be experienced by the ordinary American, will have a catastrophic effect on American society, because in the past 20 years, American society has been more than ever before dispersed outside of center cities into the bands of territory around the major cities, what we call sprawl, or, you know, the outer suburbs.
I'm sorry to say, really, that the suburban family in America is really going down the wrong path. So what is the impact on the ordinary citizen around? Well, for a few years, he can buy another large car. He can smile that there's not a cloud on the horizon. And then the crisis, when it hits, is that much worse. And there's a strange irony in this business, because the more efficient you are in producing the stuff, the more skilled you are, all the good things that one generally sees as positive attributes, the better you are at doing this, all you are really doing is accelerating the depletion and making the situation worse.
The other big squeeze in the suburbs is going to be home heating. And as most homeowners already know, at times that can get expensive. And this last winter, it was particularly wild. We almost ran out of gas in the Northeast. We barely made it. in the sense that the, you know, the red light lit that says low on fuel.
The United States is reliant for only 15% of its natural gas from Canada. Conversely, the people in the United States are clueless about the fact that that very same 15% is over half of Canada's production. If people in the United States think that that relationship can go on forever, given the natural gas production has just peaked in North America, they're crazy. And we need to adjust in the natural gas realm more rapidly, more aggressively than we do in the oil realm. There are absolutely no quick solutions. Zero.
God does set his own limits. I believe that he likes to test humankind from time to time. And I think the test is going to come very, very soon.
The end of cheap oil and gas is coming. But we have all come to take for granted their benefits. Our affluence in North America, our new cars, our suburban lifestyles, all this is dependent on an abundance of cheap oil and gas. What will be the consequences as fossil fuels become more scarce and more expensive?
We've had this incredible period of 50 years of relative world peace and stability. And I think that it's put the American public into a kind of consensus trance, that the world has always been stable, that there's very little relative danger to us in these things that happen around the world, and that we'll probably prevail in the face of all of these things, and that our so-called economy will just keep on chugging along no matter what.
It's in everybody's interest to maintain the facade that this way of life is normal. This is what we should expect. This is what we should expect for our children. And by golly, we should go out and continue buying and consuming like there's no tomorrow.
Urban planner James Howard Kunstler.
The economic benefits of living in a very stable world, meaning we're not at war with China, that means that we can enjoy a lot of benefits of having them manufacture all our stuff. We're used to getting all of our household goods now from 12,000 miles away. They're made in China. You know, everything from frying pans to underpants. What's going to happen if those supply lines to China are interrupted? You know, what might happen if we have a contest with the Republic of China over the remaining oil in the Middle East and Central Asia? Is Walmart going to continue to, you know, get the steady stream of everything from toilet seats to fishing rods from Chinese factories? In North America, I think that we're going to have to downsize and downscale everything we do. Everything from farming to education to the way we deploy ourselves in living in the landscape, sports. You know, everything that we do is going to have to be made smaller. The age of the 3,000-mile Caesar salad is coming to an end. We're going to have to grow more food closer to where we live around our towns.
Not only will food prices skyrocket, but the ability of the North American continent to produce food will diminish rapidly. The so-called Green Revolution, which took place in the 40s and 50s, saw an incredible explosion in the amount of food produced on the North American continent.
A field of carrots never touched by a hoe. A petroleum-derived weed killer knocked out the weeds when the carrots were only sprouts. Agricultural experts fight an endless battle against insect pests that ruin millions of dollars worth of crops a year. Oil-based sprays and oil-derived chemicals are among their most effective weapons.
Soil degradation has effectively rendered much of our agricultural land to be nothing more than a sponge onto which we pour petroleum-based chemicals to grow food. Not only are all fertilizers made out of natural gas, all commercial pesticides are made from petroleum. Not to mention the energy that's used in planting, harvesting, pumping the water for irrigation, packaging the food, processing the food, transporting the food, etc.
There's really going to be an end to that. And when it ends, we're going to be in real trouble. You know, it's not going to be just a matter of not being able to drive to the mall. It's going to be a matter of not knowing how you're going to feed your children.
Thank you.
in the U.S. and North America, we consume 10 calories of hydrocarbon energy for every calorie of food we eat, not counting transportation and cooking. That's an enormous out-of-balance equation.
A lot of people, I think, are going to be engaged in the production of food in ways that they can't imagine right now. Farming is liable to become a lot more labor-intensive in the years ahead, meaning, you know, a lot more people are going to have to work at it. How are people going to get to their work? What kind of work is there going to be? Who's actually going to do the real work of creating things of value, especially when we can't get toilet seats from China anymore? We're going to have to reorganize local and regional networks of economic interdependency, in which local people produce things, sell things, move things around on a much smaller and more local scale. In the United States, we have a railroad system that the Bulgarians would be ashamed of. You know, we desperately are going to need railroad transport for moving people around, for moving goods around. And we don't have that. What we do have is a trucking system which is probably going to become increasingly dysfunctional, especially as the expense mounts of maintaining the tremendous interstate highway system, which costs so much money every year to maintain at what the engineers call a high level of service, which means that the trucks that are delivering things from the Central Valley of California to Toronto don't break their axles while they're bringing those Caesar salads to Toronto. Once you have a certain number of trucks that are breaking their axles in that 3,000-mile journey, that's the end of transcontinental trucking, which also implies that's the end of certain economic relationships that we've gotten used to. The Walmarts of North America have very efficiently and effectively destroyed almost every local and regional network of economic commercial interdependency, and those networks are going to have to be rebuilt. We're going to have to learn how to do retail again on the local level, and we're not prepared for that, and it's a tremendous, awesome project.
James Howard Kunstler, ending with a quick overview of the changes that need to be made right now. Among them, relocalizing agriculture, relocalizing commerce, and replacing interstate highways with railroads. If this sounds incredibly ambitious, there's an unspoken, easier alternative. The extremely rich stay extremely rich, everyone else is plunged into poverty, and an increasingly repressive national security apparatus makes sure that the impoverished 99% are powerless to change the system. Hey, it works in Latin America. It can work here too. And on that cheerful note, I thank you for listening to New World Notes. Come back next week for part two of the documentary, The End of Suburbia. You'll get to my non-carborundum, newworldnotes.blogspot.com, and ciao.